I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Akhenaten is the third in a trilogy of big portrait operas composed by our guest Philip Glass. After Einstein and Gandhi, Philip Glass dropped back from science and politics to ancient Egypt and to the religious radical pharaoh Akhenaten, who built a new civilization around monotheism through a tumultuous 17-year reign. This opera has the signature Philip Glass sound with those cycles of chords shifting ever so slightly. The orchestra is void of violins to give it a dark, brooding sound. The libretto is written by Philip Glass himself, taken from tablets found by archaeologists at the ancient site of Amarna, the city that Akhenaten built. Philip Glass throws a curve into the casting of Akhenaten by assigning the title role not to a bass or a baritone, but to a countertenor who sings in the pitch range of his wife Nefertiti and his mother Queen Tai. Boston Lyric Opera production of Akhenaten is directed by Mary Zimmerman, who sets up the stage to match visually the music of Philip Glass. The sets are structurally simple but richly colorful. The opera's got dance scenes, falling sand, strobing flashlights. As the opera begins, we're in the middle of a funeral procession for Akhenaten's father, Amenhotep III. On the eve of great changes in ancient Egypt, Glass's music and Zimmerman's sets give you the effect almost of flying. Composer Philip Glass joins us in our studio. The director, Mary Zimmerman, joins us by phone from Chicago. Connection listeners, give them a call at 1-800-423-8255. We're experiencing Philip Glass's opera, Akhenaten, this hour on The Connection. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. Welcome back to The Connection, Philip Glass.
Thank you. Very pleased to be here.
You, Mary Zimmerman, welcome to you, too. Last night, Philip Glass saw this production, your production for the first time he's seen the opera in 15 years. I wish you'd just give us a report from your orchestra seat, Philip Glass.
Well, you know, it was very exciting to see the opera again, because, like, to be truthful, I had forgotten parts of it. One of the things that of course, I was thinking about what I had seen in 1984, which was a production in Germany and a different one in London and in Houston. And those productions were very raw in a certain way, very minimal in a way, maybe more avant-garde in a certain way. What Mary's production does, it's very psychological, and it's much more about an emotional, psychological world of Akhenaten, and I like that. The other thing that Mary does that she's actually closer to the libretto than the first two directors, who of course were doing the premieres, and I was with them. I wasn't working with Mary really. We met a number of times, but unfortunately I was not here for any of the rehearsals. So she was really flying out on her own, and when I got here and we talked, and I said there were certain things I was interested in, and I didn't insist. I knew better than to do that with directors. I just said, this is what I'm interested in. But what I found is that the production that we're seeing is really essentially closer to the Ignatin that I envisioned than what we had done a long time ago. Though again, it's changed. Now, this is not a way that I ever imagined it 15 years ago. The whole psychological part of it.
What do you mean by the it's a psychological presentation, meaning what?
I meant that the real emotional connection between the characters, I think, is what Murray was able to bring out. Would you agree with that, Murray?
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, to tell the truth, this is sort of the first report on the opera I've heard, and I'm hearing it from you, which is just, obviously very charged and sort of stunning experience. I love hearing you say it's psychological. I mean, that's definitely in line with everything else I do. So, yes, I would agree with you. I guess my own word for it might be that it was personal about him. That might be more what I would say, but yes, I would agree with you.
Let me testify, as never having seen the opera before last Friday night, that we care like crazy about this man at the end. I before we get into the psychology, I'd like to talk about who Philip Glass thinks Akhenaten was. And Mary, this is for you too. We've talked a lot about Akhenaten on this program recently because it's a big show of his, the artifacts at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. We've had a lot of Akhenaten specialists on the air, but nobody really could say who the man was. Here he is, this religious radical and reformer. And I asked people, should we think of him as Mao? Is he Mussolini? Is he Ataturk? Is he Ross Perot? Is he John McCain in the New Hampshire primary? What are the dimensions of this guy, and where do we draw the line between a religious fanatic and a passionate believer? Nobody really had a handle on him, and yet in this performance, we get I don't want to say any simply benign feeling about Akhenaten, but this is a real human being. This is a reflective family man. He's a struggler. He's out on a limb. He's desperate. He loses in the end, and we're involved with him. When he comes back as a ghost to the scene of his city and lets sand sort of filter through his fingers in the ruins.
Mm-hmm.
We're there with him.
Right.
How did you do that, Mary Zimmerman?
Well, I think that my whole approach with this opera was to not try to deliberately impose something that isn't there on it, just as we can't really impose what we don't know upon Akhenaten. And if you step back, just a step from what you're saying about Akhenaten, to me, who he is he's kind of symbolic of how we can't really know. He seems to me a surface for projection, to tell the truth. What came out of this production naturally came out of me and came out of Jeffrey Scott, who has this little A Star Is Born-y story with him. He came in to understudy the role and ended up singing it. He's an intensely soulful performer with a personal, loving connection to the music. He's in love with the music, and he's a very graceful and physically astute man. And so that's what it became, because I just played into his strengths as much as I could. And
it's a very curious combination, all the more that he's a countertenor. He looks like Charles Barkley, the basketball star. He sings like Lily Pond.
He's so far from Charles Barkley in his personality. That's funny. I feel I'm answering this inadequately, but like I said, like the opera for me became about an act of memory or an act of trying to know what you can't know, what remains of a life that's documented in a certain way, but absolutely incompletely, a life that people try to erase from the face of the earth, which paradoxically has made it a more important and intriguing life to people who came after. And I guess for me, the highlight of the opera for me is this moment of transcendence in a field, which, although I realize is an interpretation that I'm putting on it, for me, like, there is no other interpretation. Do you know what I mean? That just sort of came out of listening to the music. So that moment, which is not represented much in art, but which almost every person has had, usually in nature, where they feel themselves melt away into something larger.
Mary, identify that moment, and before we're done, we'll certainly try to play it and underline it. What moment are you talking about?
It's the aria of Akhenaten, which comes in the second act, and it's his hymn, which he wrote to a soul god, and it's sung in English. Philip stipulates that he wants it to be sung in the language of the country in which it's being performed, so that it has the most direct connection to the audience. It's also, Philip said to me, the first time and really only time we see Akhenaten all alone. So I kind of set up this thing, which I stole from a biography by Rizud Kapuscinski about an emperor in Ethiopia who had never touched the ground. His feet had only walked on pillows. And we set up that sort of law in the production where Akhenaten is always sort of pillowed in and out of scenes. But in this moment, he decides to step onto the earth for the very first time. At least in my production, that's the visual imposition on the scene. And so this little simple act, because it's violating a kind of visual rule that has been set up, becomes for me very dense and very compacted and very ecstatic, actually. So it's a moment when he's surrendering, to me, the idea of human authority or for a higher authority, which is coming from God, which is all around him and in him at the same time.
We'll work up to that scene, Mary Zimmerman, but I would also ask Philip Glass to sort of explain the choice of Akhenaten. Why, especially after Einstein and Gandhi, almost 4,000 years and a dense mist of sort of obscurity. Who was he to you?
The idea of this trilogy was to pick people who had changed the world through the power of ideas and not through force of arms. And so that would be Einstein, the man of science. Gandhi would have been the politician. And then they had totally changed their world. Now two of them are contemporaries. In the same way, I felt that Akhenaten had completely changed the world. I think the essential thing to remember about Akhenaten, he is the one who imposed this vision of monotheism on the world around him. Don't forget, Egypt until then was a land of a pantheistic religion. There were all kinds of gods for every water hole, for every part of the desert, for the sun, for the stars, and so forth. So what he said, no, there's only really one god, and it's my father, the Aten. And clearly he was a fanatic for sure. He also didn't care very much about what anyone else thought. That's why he got into so much trouble. I mean, the tragedy of Akhenaten is that he's so passionate about this, and he simply doesn't care what anyone else thinks.
I think we should listen carefully to the aria that Mary Zimmerman identified as central. Here it comes. Mary Zimmerman said these are among the few words in the opera that are sung in English, and I still don't hear them. What is Akhenaten saying?
Philip, do you want to answer?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about this particular hymn is that it seems so much like the Psalms of the Old Testament.
The God of the animals, the God
that's
of
right.
all creation, the God of
that's right.
And in fact, some of it is from the King James.
Well,
is it not?
No, it isn't. But it may be the other way around. Maybe that the King James is from Akhenaten, and this is the real point. And by the way, when this song is finished, when this aria is finished, the chorus does in fact begin to sing the psalm from the Old Testament, just to make that point. But the thing is that in the kind of research that I was doing, of course, one of the main books was Moses and Monotheism of
Sigmund Freud.
And he makes the suggestion that that Akhenaten was in fact the model for of this monotheistic emperor, this king. But the and that the words of Aten, he suggests that maybe the religion of Aten kind of went underground, and it resurfaces later in terms of the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm. I will say that, you know, I had the privilege when I went to Egypt and visited these sites of having the opera already composed and on a Walkman that I could listen to. And I did listen to this hymn as we approached the site, and it seemed that every single thing that was mentioned in it was outside the window of my car. The beasts were content in their pastures. The birds were on the wing. You know, it was sort of unbelievable. In the same way that you'll go in these tombs and look at the paintings and the hieroglyphics and walk outside and see the exact scene, it feels sort of timeless.
That's fascinating. I'd love to hear more about what the scene looks like. We've seen sort of computer simulations of the scene from, you know, a few rocks that are left there, Mary.
Well, Philip can tell you also, there's not much there.
There's not
empty.
Much left, no. But what is there are two important things. And I was there also some years before, of course. There are two things that I saw that I noticed. One was the horizon itself. He talks about the horizon.
Yes.
And what I wanted to do, and the reason I went there, Chris, I wanted to find a place in that valley where I could stand where I thought he might have stood and see what he might have seen.
Mm-hmm.
What I saw was the horizon. The second thing I saw was one of the carvings on the side of the cliffs, which was a carving of him, which the driver I was with said, "Oh, do you want to see something carved in the rock?" And I said, "Of course." And it turned out to be the image became one of the scenes of the opera, the scene of him with his children.
Mm-hmm.
The five daughters?
Yes, the six daughters.
Six daughters, sorry. Mm-hmm. You know, Mary, I just want to note that the whole production here and the look of it is sort of wonderfully real without being in any way, there are no sort of cliche Egyptian postures or outlines or animal heads or...
Oh, yeah, there's two animal heads.
There's a couple animal heads.
Oh, no, there are animal heads, but they're not out of that sort of universal storybook that we've all copied. That's a huge point in its favor because it feels, one can imagine this is a sort of Nile culture, but it's something quite fresh and new unto itself. Go ahead.
Well, the set designer and I, to tell the truth, when we walked in and saw the set in scale, you know, done up there, but not under the enchantment of light yet, I think we both were slightly horrified. Like, we thought, oh, no, it's what we wanted to avoid. It's monumental. It's a little bit monolithic. It's architectural. But under the enchantment of light and, I guess, the staging around and, of course, the music bathing it, that set can kind of come and go, it feels to me. I did feel like it was too representational when I first looked at it in scale. I felt like, oh, what a horrifying mistake, and what it should be is a few pieces of silk.
I think you did achieve that. I don't think anything is wrong with it being mine. I mean, the subject is mine. You know, the thing about Akhenaten is talking about the biggest things a human being can talk about.
Well, that's the other point that I just wanted to get Philip Glass to talk about. This is not, in any way, a kind of cliche pharaoh either. This is a human being struggling with big universal questions.
Well, this is the... let me say, when I first... that also came out of my visit to... I went to the Cairo Museum and when I wrote, maybe 1980, and you walk through the museum and there's one faceless pharaoh after another.
Mm-hmm.
Then you walk into this
faceless
room...
Faceless meaning?
Faceless meaning...
Well, faceless.
They're the same.
Yeah. They all look the same. Then you walk into this one room called the Armana Room, and suddenly there's a human being there, and it is so almost shocking.
It is.
And then I saw that in the same manner that he appears in the museum, he must have appeared like that to the people of his time. That's why he ends up being a countertenor. He was so shocking a character that the only way that I could describe him, I wanted to indicate in a very simple way, in a very direct way, without creating a lot of more storylines and stuff that I didn't really want to get involved with, how disturbing, shocking, and bewildering he must have been to the people of his time.
It's the parallel in the museum show of these people coming alive. Also, it connects for me in a strange way with the sort of in the Florentine museums when the Renaissance sort of when it comes alive and you move from those sort of two-dimensional gilt Madonnas to those fabulously human Filippo Lippi paintings. There's something like that going on here. But I still, you really haven't answered the question, Philip Glass. Who was this man? Would we have liked him? Was he one of us?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think we would have liked. I don't think he would have liked us. He was very involved. From what we know, he was kind of locked up in the palace with his wonderful Nefertiti and his mother. That was already something strange going on there. Then his six daughters, something maybe strange going on there too. Then Tutankhamun, his son, don't forget. This is a guy who really let the affairs of state really slide by. He was, at the end, there's a scene where they keep rushing up to him. Mary, you did this so beautifully, where they come rushing up with these letters to read about. And they're talking
about... Kingdom's falling apart.
The kingdom's falling apart. And, you know, he kind of looks a little worried, and then a few minutes later, he's thinking again. He's with his daughters. He doesn't get it. You know, basically, because in fact, he is so convinced that he's the son of Aten, he is the part of the Godhead himself, that he doesn't think that anything can happen to him.
Our guests are Philip Glass, the composer, and Mary Zimmerman, the director of the production in Boston of Philip Glass's opera, Akhenaten, 1-800-423-8255. We haven't talked about the music yet, but we will. 1-800-423-TALK. Adam is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, Adam.
Thank you. I was at the show last night, and I want to thank both of your guests. It was a pleasure. It was a great evening. It was interesting. It was beautiful. It was dramatic. And it was a treat to have Mr. Glass there.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
I just want to comment on one aspect of the show, and about Akhenaten. He not only brought about a political and theological revolution, but what was also evident at the MFA show was that he brought about an artistic revolution. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was interesting the musical language which he used for Akhenaten himself, and because part of it was that he was a countertenor, and that voice comes out so oddly. But even that high-pitched, almost barking sound is so odd. And I think that was very much consistent with what one saw at the MFA exhibit about how he depicted the human figure, or how the human figure was depicted in his city, and how differently things were done artistically as well. Mm-hmm. But it was a wonderful evening, very surprising and quite beautiful.
Thank you. By the way, he used to say he called himself the one who walks in truth. Mm-hmm. And what you said is a very good point, that he was also a revolution in the artistic representation. It's much more naturalistic. He was a very distorted physically, and he wanted to be presented that way.
I actually disagree with Philip that he was distorted physically, but
Well, we're talking about medical archaeology now, so we can argue about that as much
as
we want to, Mary.
My guide in Egypt had a different opinion, so that's why I believe him. But in any case, I do think that Philip's one of the great theatrical sort of coups or ideas of the opera is to make him a countertenor and let that analogously stand in for distortion. You know, mm-hmm. I think it's beautiful, a beautiful and intensely theatrical and dramatic idea.
You know, we'll have to talk about the music when we kind of come out of the break. Philip Glass, you've heard all those, I mean, people make jokes about Philip Glass arpeggios and these endless repetitions. There's a chord there that goes virtually all night. And yet the thing we've got to talk about is how these repetitive chords become so beautiful and carry such a huge emotional freight through this opera. I don't know exactly how to ask that question. The point is, I want to tease you a little bit about the stuck in the groove sound, because I also want to sort of say what I can about how beautiful they become and how much dramatic and sentimental a freight they carry through the whole show. We're not joking about it by the end. We're talking about the opera Akhenaten with the composer Philip Glass and the director of the Boston and Chicago show, Mary Zimmerman. We're going to take a short break. First, a duet between Akhenaten and his wife Nefertiti. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Philip Glass Akhenaten Connection.
Oh.
Philip Glass is our guest. We're talking about the opera Akhenaten, which he wrote in 1982-83, first performed in 84. He saw it last night in Boston for the first time in 15 years. We're joined also by the director, the young director of this new production, Mary Zimmerman, who joins us by phone from Chicago. Philip Glass, could we talk a little bit about the music here? The music is
well,
the music and the construction of it.
I've been thinking about your question, and I'm actually going to try to answer it, which I don't usually do. I get asked this question a lot. I usually don't answer it. But this time, let me try it this way. I'm going to try a serious answer. You know, when we talk about something that repeats, and the trick from the point of view of the composer is to make keep the listener listening to something that keeps repeating. Well, in order to do that, it actually doesn't keep repeating. There are changes going on all the time. The strategy of writing repetitive music is that it actually doesn't repeat. Now, what is the point of that? The point is the following. Once you've got the listener's attention listening to something in which not very much happens, there becomes a kind of a total attention to the music, which allows, and you talk about the emotional freight. I think that what happens is that when our attention to the music opens up, and it does through this kind of these kind of gradually changing, shifting, repeating things, what happens is that we become open to all kinds of emotional stimuli which might be hidden at other times.
Do you want to be more particular? What kinds of stimuli? Or
well, you know, and this is where I can't really tell you what you're going to feel. I think in Mary's production, you also, we can suggest things. As I put it this way, we can't tell you what something means. We can tell you that it's meaningful, but you're the one that tells us what it means.
Mary, did you, this is a moment to ask Philip Glass those questions you never did ask before.
She asked me already.
What about those chords?
Well, you know, I was helped out so beautifully by the conductor, Beatrice Afrin, who...
Who's marvelous, yeah.
Who's absolutely marvelous, a total babe in every way, and a gift to the production, to my experience of it. And she would... help me with the music by saying, this took us a couple weeks to develop, and she would say to me, okay, Mary, it goes like this, and she would be talking about the different phrases. She'd say it goes A prime, B, B, B prime, then that repeats, then C, C. She would do that kind of breakdown for me, which I understood it was sort of in poetic terms, how you would label end rhyme in poetry. And that helped me occupy the music, which it was always a challenge, and I'm telling you, in every minute I was conscious of this, not to freight the music, not to illustrate or ornament it, but to be in dialogue and responsive to it, not to have the image overpower it, but not to have the image not amplify it, you know, but be flat or whatever. So my experience of the music is that I've been a Philip Glass fan since I was a young teen. I saw Koi Anaskatsi, actually, in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I just have always felt the music to be intensely emotional in a way that I can't quite describe, but I think is, you know, it's absolutely true.
Well, I think you may have said a lot when you talk about repetition that isn't really repetition, or repetition that accentuates the significance of one note changing in a four-note chord or something. It did remind me of something people used to say about McCoy Tyner, the pianist, who was John Coltrane's pianist, but then went through a period, I suppose, in the early 80s, maybe, 70s, when he used to sit on a big chord and pound it. It seemed forever. And somebody would say, well, what did McCoy play last night? And somebody would say, well, in the first set, he played an E minor seventh chord. And that was, and that was that. This feels like an A minor chord forever and ever and ever.
And it is. Someone said that I think one writer very early on, he said, the opera is wrapped in a shroud of 8 minor.
Yes, it's beautiful.
Wow. Well, I heard it right then. But
yeah.
The funny thing for you, Mary, is that there's some sense in which the kind of color-saturated richness of the look of this show, in which the sets are basically drops and very simple, and the costumes too, matches the music in some fashion.
You know, it's interesting you should say that. Our costume designer had a very geometric feel about the music, and that's how she, that inspired her costume-wise. I realize I don't want to miss this opportunity that you just gave me to ask Philip things, and I would love to ask him. He said that you said, Philip, you'd forgotten certain things. What, when you saw it last night, like, what had you forgotten that you saw again, and what did you... Did you feel like, oh, this is really good, or did you feel like, oh, why did I do that?
Well, the only thing I should mention that we put the intermission in a different place.
Yeah.
We have one intermission right in the middle, and the original production had two intermissions, kind of a third and two-thirds through. I like this this arrangement.
I do, too. I think structurally it's really great.
But that meant that I looked at the whole opera differently. I never seen it before, like, in two parts. I've only seen it in three parts. Now, I think... what I see now when I see it in two parts is I see that the story is as direct as I want it to be. It's basically the rise and fall of Akhenaten, you know, and nothing much else happens, and nothing much else has to happen. That's about what you can do in 2 hours and 10 minutes, really. the things that I forgot, and I can't know how I forgot this, but I forgot about the duet, that poem that he and Nefertiti did.
Really?
I don't know why I forgot that. That was sort of...
I breathe the sweetness of your breath, kind of thing.
Yeah, and when that started, I said, it kind of took my breath away. Not that it was so beautiful that I wrote it, but that, how could I have forgotten that beautiful poem?
Yes.
And there it was. There was that, and then, let's see, what else? The beginning of the coronation I also hadn't remembered quite so well. But what I thought, by the way, I thought the duet was very beautifully staged. Also, one of the things that I liked of this was at the end when he's getting the letters. I meant to mention this, and then what Mary has him do, he gathers up the letters and they stuff them into two jars. Then they seal the jars and they're sent. And these, of course, are the jars that we later find them in. So she carries this idea of. At one point, the opera flips way into the present, and in a way...
tourists on the site, yeah.
Yeah, and the way by that I thought was a reference to what we will later, how we will later find these relics.
It's the preservation of the memory. We get to see that moment of it, and it's through the scribe's agency. You know, which I think goes with your idea of that ideas are what last. Admittedly, I sort of elide Akhenaten's ideas into the scribes, and the Amarna letters are not by Akhenaten, but the idea of this, that someone had the wisdom to save something. Well, in my opinion, like while the palace is sort of falling around him.
It's very moving, actually, how that works. That way.
Right, and then to have the scribe be the tour guide, which is your idea at the end, you know, and he sort of gestures in the same way that he did when he used to be showing the letters to Akhenaten. I think it's really beautiful.
We're talking about the opera Akhenaten, about the sort of runaway rebel breakthrough pharaoh of almost 2,000 years before Christ. Philip Glass wrote it. Mary Zimmerman directs the new performance of it in Boston. We're doing what the professionals call notes on last night's performance, talking it over. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Philip Glass's Akhenaten connection. Antonia is on the line.
Good morning.
Welcome, Antonia.
I saw the opera on Friday. I thought it was absolutely stupendous. I think I wanted to make a comment and then ask a question. I think the thing that struck me the most about it was the sense of how people's characters are not revealed by public documents. You know, there was no invented dialogue.
Yeah.
And I think that made the scene at the end where he's a ghost looking at these tourists, looking at his crumbling buildings, gave you such a sense of him as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And that they didn't know that, and we don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
The question I wanted to ask was when he was singing, he looked pained, and the question was, was that the rigors of the difficult singing, or do you think that these revolutionary ideas he had were sort of thrust upon him, or that he felt that they were divine inspiration? Do you think he found these ideas difficult to handle?
Philip Glass.
Well, I think that's Mary's question.
I think that what you're seeing on Jeffrey's face may be in part the effort and concentration of doing the singing, but I also think that he's feeling into the music in a particular way that just simply moves him in a way beyond his control. I noticed also that he is that he's so moved by the ordeal of going through this opera, actually, that he does have that expression of intensity upon him, which I lean into and like. But I'm not a singer, and I didn't necessarily... I directed Jeffrey. I nudged him in certain directions at certain moments. I wanted to see him smile in the field. But, you know, he's physically, physiologically responding to the task of what he's doing and emotionally to how it makes him feel. Okay. I don't know. I assume Akhenaten did have a kind of difficult life, and so it feeds into that.
Antonia, who was he for you by the end?
Who Akhenaten. Was he?
Yeah.
Well... I had thought initially, after the Museum of Fine Arts exhibition, that he was more sort of, like you get the impression of Mozart, someone who just, these things just happened to him and he dealt with the things very lightly. But after I saw the opera, he did seem like he was more pained, mm-hmm. that it was difficult for him to think these things and to believe them and to impose them.
He tried to start a utopia, and it eventually failed. But I'll tell you, and Philip and I both had this experience in the Cairo Museum, the statues of him, even though they're broken apart and parts of his body replaced by black granite, they tower above the modern tourists in that museum in this beatific... self-assured, beautiful and confident and triumphant way. And I think of him as that way somehow, because he did live his life according to what he believed. Like, his life every moment was a manifestation of what he believed.
Very true. Fascinating. Antonia, thanks for the questions and the thoughts. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Akhenaten connection with Philip Glass and Mary Zimmerman. Eric is on the line.
Hi, this is more on the music in general, because I haven't seen the opera, but one thing I found is that this idea of long seeming repetition with slight variations, it seems really closely aligned to the use of extended rest in music. And I think either Thelonious Monk or even Jan Sibelius sometimes. And also I was interested in both what influence that type of approach to music has had on Mr. Glass's music, and also the influence of chant.
Thelonious or Sibelius? Or were they the same
person?
They're
both good. They're both good. In fact, I knew both of that music. I know that music very well. I spent my student years also in Chicago, at the University of Chicago, in the 50s. I heard a lot of jazz then, and Thelonious was one of the people I listened to. The idea of rest is a very nice idea, because... I think of it as not so much as rest as spaciousness. And sometimes when I'm working on music, and I remember something that John Cage once told, he was talking to theater people that I knew, and they asked him how long a piece should be, and he said it should be as long as it takes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a funny, maybe not an answer, but in a way really a wonderful answer, because when I'm sometimes writing and I feel one of the things that I, the most difficult and demanding thing is to figure how is to let things be as long as they need to be,
mm-hmm.
and so for me the rest is a kind of space. And sometimes when in a piece I'll say I need this space here, and this it's almost like an architectural idea of space.
Mm-hmm.
Eric, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Akhenaten connection. Keith is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Keith. Welcome.
Well, I'm quite glad you're having this discussion, because the reviews have been mixed, and this seems much better from the horse's mouth. I should say to you, Chris, that you're responsible for my going out and buying every CD of Philip Glass that I could lay my hands on.
Wow.
After
15% of how many CDs?
Well, I don't... I'll ship you the cut.
Okay.
But it was after your production on Dracula that fascinated me, and I should say that I draft to the music, and it's absolutely true that listening to the subtle changes is extraordinarily satisfying after you listen to it and listen to it and listen to it. I would like you to say more about how you came about the production, since I'm a designer, and just about the thinking of the physical production, and the choice of, once again, the choice of the countertenor. And I wonder for Mr. Glass whether there's, and it was any relation to Gluck's Orpheus, which it sounds a little like to me.
Interesting. At the, I did a production of an opera called Orfeu here at in Boston at ART in Cambridge, American Repertory Theater, in which I actually did quote Gluck. The original film quotes Gluck, so I re-quoted it, so to speak. I think that this production really was Mary's production. I saw it for the first time last night, so I think she should address the question about the
But
production.
The countertenor is written into the opera.
Yes, right? It is. And in a way, it's been, you know, it's interesting. When I did that, Chris, it was not the great revival of countertenors hadn't begun yet. So in 1982 and 83, when I was doing this piece, I didn't know that many countertenors around. I found Paul Eswood, who was a very good one. But now there seems to have been a great boom and revival in countertenors, and by God, I've got a countertenor opera. So things are, it's kind of lucky in a way that it was not planned in that way. Mm-hmm. Really, the choice of countertenor was, I can't say much more about it. It really was, it was for a character recognition and for, I was looking for a shorthand. You know, you don't have much time in the opera house. You have 2 hours to tell a very long, complicated story. And what you do, there are little techniques or tricks to get information into the opera as quickly as you can. And by having him open, the other thing is, don't forget, he doesn't sing till the end of the first act. So you see this kind of gorgeous creature walking around the stage. You have no idea what's going to happen. And I was sitting next to someone who I brought from New York who didn't know what was going to happen. And at the end of the first act, suddenly he opens up and the sound comes out. And this friend turned to me and said, "My God, why did you do that?" And I said to her, "Because he is so strange." And many people who come to the opera know the word countertenor, but they maybe have not really heard the sound. Mm-hmm. This particular man, Jeffrey, has a beautiful, he's not just a countertenor, he's almost like a soprano. Mm-hmm. He has a strong upper range, which countertenors often don't have. Mm-hmm. So that he is able to really project the sound very forcefully, and so when he first begins to sing, you can feel the audience almost catch their breath, and that was what I wanted to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mary Zimmerman, Keith wanted you to talk about the design of this whole production.
Right. Well, I mean, it's, you know, a great privilege to get to design anything and to work on anything. It's my favorite almost part of the process is working with my collaborators, and I got to choose my old colleagues that I've worked with many times before. And, you know, we all listen to the opera. We meet as much as we can. We first try and just talk about what the parts of the opera we like the best, the parts we're obsessed with, what seems to, you know, we want to give priority to, what it makes us feel. I did go to Egypt. Philip sent me to Egypt. I had a great, great adventure there, which
was the adventure?
My adventure is a sort of another program, but I was accompanied all the time by anywhere from 6 to 30 armed men. The region is not as tranquil as it was when Philip went 15 years ago, and they were very upset that I was there, so I had a lot of police escort, and at one place I was the first Western visitor in 4 years, and there was a lot of ceremony around me and a lot of nervousness around me. But I did get inspired in Egypt by the expanse, the emptiness. Sorry, this is my phone. Has a very bad connection.
Yeah, Philip Glass did not write the phone part here. Okay.
Thank you, Chris.
The sort of emptiness of the desert very much inspired me. And, you know, I work with people that I've worked with a lot, and so we just endlessly chat, endlessly visit. The way we did the window and the window of appearances was a very last-moment idea. Initially, it was a very Egypt-y, large sort of plexiglass thing. But suddenly, I just had the idea of conflating the idea of the window of appearances with a museum frame or window and a very long horizontal frame. It also suggests that which can be seen, that which is seen publicly, and that which is not seen, which is sort of happening underneath the frame. And I didn't quite realize that I had seen such a frame in the Cairo Museum. On the stairwells, there were these intensely long, narrow frames custom built around long pieces of papyrus, like 18 feet long.
Mary, I'm gonna hold you right there just to say we're gonna go out on the music of Akhenaten by Philip Glass. And Philip, I just say as a last word, I mean, Egypt is the ultimate tie-in these days, from Aida to your opera to all sorts of other stuff going on. But I didn't get it, in a way, till I saw this opera. I'd seen the museum show, but this is the piece that's going to make me an Egyptologist.
It's a wonderful... You know, the great thing about the subject is there's not much to read about. You can read a dozen books and you've kind of got it.
Well, start with the opera, too. Thank you, Philip Glass and Mary Zimmerman. The Boston Lyric Opera's performance of Akhenaten continues through this week, and then Chicago this coming summer. We had help today from George Hicks, Glenn Alexander, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. Special thanks to Mary Zimmerman and Philip Glass. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
Egypt and Syria were found here and are now in the Cairo Museum. To see any sites on the eastern bank of the river, you must cross by ferry, which carries cars along with the usual donkey carts and local traffic. Ferry docking station is located at the southern end of the town. You should arrive there at least 1.5 hour before the 6 a.m. crossing. The ferry does a brisk business, and you will need every available second for sightseeing. There is nothing left of this glorious city of temples and palaces. The mud brick buildings have long since crumbled, and little remains of the immense stone temples but the outlines of their floor plans. In addition to the tombs and ruins of the city, there are several stelae scattered around the plain which mark the limits of the land belonging to the city. Most of them are too widely scattered to visit and are also in bad condition.